This is American Dissident Voices. This is a program speaking for Americans who believe in freedom rather than in political correctness, who value quality above equality, and are willing to do whatever must be done to restore America to racial and moral health and her public institutions to sanity and integrity. This is a program speaking for Americans who dissent from the United States government's policies of multiculturalism and enforced diversity and globalism. This program is the voice of America's dissidents who are speaking out to America's patriots and to patriots of our Western civilization around the world in order that we may learn together and work together for a better future for us all.
Today we welcome to the American Dissident Voices microphones Mr. David Duke, a man who has been raising the consciousness of European Americans since the early 1970s. He was the first openly pro-white elected representative since the 1960s, and he garnered over 60% of the white vote in runs for the Senate and governor in Louisiana in the 1990s. More recently, he is the author of the books My Awakening and Jewish Supremacism, and is just now in the process of being released from an imprisonment widely viewed as politically motivated by Zionist forces within the Bush administration. Welcome to American Dissident Voices, David Duke.
I'm so glad to be here, Kevin, and I'm very honored to be here. I've really admired your program and your commentary and your dedication to our cause for a very, very long time, and it's really a great pleasure for me to be on your program and to share my thoughts with your audience.
It's a pleasure to have you, David. Now, you've been shut in for more than a year, but I know from our correspondence and our conversations you haven't been idle. What have you been doing during your involuntary sabbatical?
Well, I feel like I've been in a monastery, in a sense. It's a very crazy monastery. I was in a room, I guess, with approximately 72 other prisoners. I'd say 90% of them were non-European, either Mexican or black. You could imagine the amount of noise in that kind of facility, the kind of conditions that exist there. The bunks were only about 30 inches apart. So it was a very difficult situation. But when you're in prison, you're basically stripped to your core. You go into prison, and the only thing you have, you don't even have a wristwatch. You just, you know, you basically come in there with your skin and what you are inside, what's in your soul. And if you go into prison and you have some strength inside you, you're made stronger. And if you're weak, you're made weaker. And prison, for me, it was a very strengthening experience. And being away from the physical pleasures of life, I mean, not eating tasty food, not having any of the basic enjoyments or even the small pleasures of life, which we take for granted on the outside, causes you to examine your own soul, your own spirit, and to look for the really greater pleasures of life and the most important pleasures of life. And that's really satisfying the inner longing we have in our genes, the values that we have, the beliefs that we have, the commitments we have in life. So in a way, I was in a very obscure place. I had a chance to do a lot of thinking. It was a monastery, but it was kind of a monastery and a zoo.
Last week, I mentioned your Unity and Leadership Conference, which is coming up this Memorial Day weekend. I imagine that a lot of your time since you've been able to get back to your office has been taken up in getting ready for that. Can you tell us a little bit about that and also about the purpose of the conference?
Well, it's really twofold. The conference is really the idea for it was begun by a lot of my friends here who wanted to have a good welcoming home meeting from me. And I've got many friends around the country, including yourself and Eric Leiby, Dr. Edward Field, so many people around the country, the world, that wanted to kind of welcome me back from the American gulag. And I thought to myself, well, if we're going to have this get-together, this homecoming, that we should also have a meeting in the process, international meeting of Europeans and Americans, who are involved in the struggle for the preservation of our heritage, our way of life, and our freedoms. And I also have been thinking for a long time over the years that we do need some sort of a code of action between us, some sort of code of conduct in terms of how we're going to treat each other, an integrity that we have between organizations. And we don't need to merge into one group. In fact, that might be a dangerous thing, because if we all got into one group, it would give the Jewish supremacists a more clear target at which to aim.
Right.
And if they could destroy all of us. The European mankind is in an absolute crisis. We are literally being wiped off the face of the earth. And it's hard for people to understand this. And I'm sure there's some people new to the cause and new to these ideas who are listening to your program. But they've got to get into their mind that what's happening here is an absolute battle for our survival. European birth rates now, both in America and Europe, are about 1.25, which means for every 100 European men and women, you only have about 68 children. And that generation, at 68 children, only has somewhere around 40. And that the next generation, in short, in four or five generations, we go from 100 European Americans down to less than 10. We're being wiped out. In the blink of an eye, we're being wiped out.
Those figures don't even take into account miscegenation.
Exactly. And it doesn't count the massive influx of third worlders into European countries. And what's happening is at the same time, the European people, people of European descent, are not having children. The population explosion is going on all over the non-white world. And these people not only staying in their own countries, but they're flooding into European lands. Now, the reason we want to preserve our heritage isn't because we hate these third worlders or these non-whites that exist in South America or Mexico or China or South Asia or India or whatever. We don't hate them. But we certainly believe that we have a right to preserve our heritage, our way of life, our freedoms, our culture, our genetics.
We need our own exclusive living space to do that. Do you agree with that?
I think absolutely we do. And I think that can be worked out between the races. I think what's keeping us from coming to a fair, I've been around the world, and of course I've traveled to the Arab countries. One reason why I went to the Gulag was because I went to Bahrain and spoke before a group called Discover Islam, which was an anti-Israel organization, and I appeared in Al Jazeera. In fact, the State Department, the U.S. State Department, and this is admitted in Newsweek magazine, by the way, in their Periscope section of November 2002, they actually tried to prevent my appearance in Al Jazeera. They threatened the Al Jazeera network and said, if you have David Duke on, we're not going to give you White House credentials. We're not going to let you set up an office in Washington, D.C., in the United States, and so forth, which your network needs for credibility around the world.
Sounds like they're afraid of you, or somebody is.
Well, it seems that way. And the interesting thing was that the network didn't cave in, and the United States never followed through on their threats, but they tried to keep me off the air over there. Within 30 days, I was prosecuted by the Justice Department in this case. And the pressure for that came out of Washington and Michael Chertoff's office. And Michael Chertoff was the same individual whom I exposed for letting go the Israeli spies at 9/11. As most of your listeners know, that there was a huge Israeli spy network in the United States operating before and after 9/11, and they were in fact spying and very closely spying on the so-called Al-Qaeda individuals who were here, the hijackers. Five of these Israeli spies lived in the same street as Mohammed Atta, the hijacker leader. And five Israeli Mossad agents were arrested on a rooftop, filming the attacks on the Trade Center and cheering those attacks. In fact, they were posing in front of the burning Trade Center, flicking lighters. You know how great this is. And I think, there's no question about the fact we do know there were early warnings to Israeli citizens in the Trade Center. This has been exposed by the Washington Post. It's been exposed by the FBI. There were early warnings to Israeli nationals that were at the Trade Center. I think the Mossad was completely aware that these attacks were going to go on. And I'm certainly suspicious that they might have had something to do in terms of instigating these attacks by their infiltrators in the Al-Qaeda network. I can't prove that fact, but we do know, without any question, that the Mossad had prior knowledge that these attacks were going to take place and treacherously let these terrible attacks go on, knowing that these attacks would better Israel's situation in the world, would make America support Israel in its suppression of the Palestinians. They didn't want me talking about these issues and these facts on Al Jazeera and throughout the world. And the State Department tried to prevent me from talking about these issues. I also exposed this war. As you know, and you did the same thing, so it's not just David Duke, but I traveled the world. I spoke at many international conferences in Europe, and I was well respected at those conferences. I spoke with heads of state, with ambassadors to major nations. They share the podium with me, and I discuss the Israeli aspects against the Palestinian. I discuss this coming war against Iraq, and I said from the very get-go that there's no evidence that Saddam has any weapons of mass destruction. If they did have evidence, they'd produce it. They'd have the inspectors go find it. I said that Saddam had no ties with Al-Qaeda. I said that this war would be a quagmire and be destructive to America. I said it would really help terrorism and endanger America rather than help America, and that it would cost hundreds of billions of dollars. And at this time, Wolfowitz and Pearl and the rest of this Jewish supremacist cadre in Washington, they just said, oh, no, no, this is going to be an easy war. It's going to cost $20 or $30 billion. The people are going to welcome us with flowers, and this is going to be a great blow against terrorism. Well, as you know, what this war has created is it's created 100 million young men around the world who are growing up dreaming of becoming a bin Laden.
Our ideas, Dr. Pierce's ideas, were revolutionary. I believe your ideas are revolutionary, and so are mine. I mean, we want a reordering of values, a civilization based on the ideals of racial integrity, racial progress, and self-determination for whites. Now, there must be tremendous pressure on someone in the political arena, as you've been in the political arena, to water down those ideas and to say that we just want equality or fairness. How have you avoided doing that?
Well, because, first off, and let's make it very clear, politics is a little bit different than a person that presenting a philosophical idea. And when you're in a political race, what you've got to talk about, and this is just simple political dynamics, you've got to talk about the issues that are motivating the voters. When you're in a race, you are not trying to change fundamental perceptions of the world. What you're trying to do is present specific ideas that are in line with your philosophy that you can get elected and then present the entire worldview that you've got to present. In other words, every election has to be geared toward winning that election. At the same time, you can't compromise what you believe. I remember in the races that I ran for Senate and governor, you know, my whole speech wasn't, of course, about the Middle East and Israel, that people weren't going to vote for me for governor of Louisiana because of our Israeli policy.
Right.
But if people asked me about Israel in the course of my discussions, I would talk about the fact that our policy in Israel was wrong, that it was hurting America, that Israel was a treacherous country, that it committed terrorism against our nation. And as far as fairness is concerned, I think we also have to consider our own approach on these issues. See, I don't think that my approach, my desire to preserve my European-American heritage, that I'm being unfair to blacks or unfair to non-whites around the world. You know, I think what I represent is actually the best for them. I think that the best thing for them at some point is to live in their own society where white people are not ruling over them, where white people are not determining how they live, where they can make a world, their own world, in their own country, their own society, their own community, that can reflect their own deepest desires and values.
There must also be tremendous pressure not to talk about the Jewish question. However, far from being a typical politician in that regard, you've made that issue the centerpiece of your most recent work.
It is the ultimate issue. And I don't like, you know, we have lots of different people in the movement. We have Jared Taylor, for instance, of American Renaissance, and we've got other people that are just concentrating only on the racial issue, and that's fine. Different people can take different approaches. But in my mind, the critical issue is the issue of Jewish power, because the Jewish supremacist power, and by the way, this is not simply Jews, it's an ideology that these Jewish leaders have, and most Jewish organizations have, that they believe that they have a divine right to rule us, to be supreme over us. It's a supremacy. It's not even a separate ideology, or it's not a separatism. It's not an egalitarianism. It is a supremacy position. Judaism, at its root, is a racial supremacist religion. And the issue, their power in media and their power in government today, not only in America, but their influence is great, of course, in England, and it still reaches into other European countries, though it's not as great as it is here, influences every other issue, whether you're talking about gun control, or whether you're talking about abortion, or whether you're talking about world trade, or whether you're talking about the Iraq war, or whether you're talking about affirmative action. This issue is the critical issue, because by determining and controlling our mass media to a great extent, they're able to dictate what happens. By controlling the politicians, they're able to dictate what happens on not just the issues affecting Israel, but many other issues affecting America. For instance, Americans are shocked. A lot of typically conservative Americans who are essentially a very much opposed from a gut feeling opposed to immigration, this mass immigration, which is transforming our nation into a third world country. They're very surprised to learn that immigration, the change in Americans' immigration policy and opening our border, that this policy was almost entirely led and affected by the Jewish supremacists. Almost every Jewish organization for the last 70 years, in fact, it took them 70 years. They started their work to undermine our immigration policy from literally the turn of the last century, the turn of the 20th century. So starting from around 1900, it took them 65 years. For 65 years, they worked to destroy America's demographic base, to make European Americans into a minority. And of course, in my book, Jewish Supremacism, I quote from many Jewish leaders bragging about the fact that they led this effort. And of course, they not only led it in terms of the actual congressional legislation, they also led it from the standpoint of the media trying to popularize this opinion, trying to tell people in America that somehow multiculturalism was a great advantage, that it was going to be a great benefit to people, when we know that so-called multiculturalism leads to greater crime, dislocation, racial insensitivity. In fact, racial tensions arise from it. That a community sense of brotherhood and togetherness and unity is destroyed by so-called multiculturalism. And when we look around the world and we see multicultural states and multicultural communities, they tend to be far more violent. They tend to be far more disruptive. There's a lot less love and a lot more hate in those kinds of environments because it's human nature. People are different. But anyway, the people who've been the architects of this change have really been Jewish supremacists. So unless we strike, you know, at that core ideologically, unless we expose this Jewish supremacist domination over our media and government, we're never going to have any real victories on these other peripheral areas.
Now, that very Jewish-controlled media you're speaking of stereotypes pro-white people as unthinking haters, bigots, advocators of mindless violence. I've been talking on this program about how we need to avoid confirming those media stereotypes, and especially since those things are not what we're about anyway. We are men. We've discussed this. We are men of peace and justice.
I think that's absolutely correct, and I think that the media for 40 years now, they've been presenting white opposition to, say, forced integration of education or to affirmative action or to immigration. They've been presenting us as violent, hateful, bigoted, that kind of a presentation. And so a lot of white working people, they see this image on television and they basically say, oh, you're supposed to oppose this by standing up and raising, you know, yelling racial epithets because that's what the media says. And there are some people in the so-called movement who call themselves white racialists who are really doing nothing more than presenting some sort of a Jewish version of what we are rather than what we really are. I'll give you an example. You know, there is an article recently on myself and on the convention that's coming up, the conference, with the international conference, and they referred to me and the people coming to the conference as, quote, white supremacists. Well, that's a term that Jewish supremacists have coined to label any white person. I am not a white supremacist, and I know that you're not, because a white supremacy means that you want to rule over other people. You know, and none of us in the movement, none of the real thinkers and leaders of this movement are white supremacists. We don't want to be supreme over others. We simply want our own. Maybe white separatists would be a better term, or simply white self-determinationists, you know, or white heritage advocates, or white preservationists. But white supremacy is not what we are. We're not trying to rule over blacks or Jews or Mexicans or any other group. We simply want our own communities, our own society to reflect that of our forefathers, what every other race on this planet wants. If we're white supremacists, then so are the Japanese are Japanese supremacists, and Indians are Indian supremacists. We are simply white preservationists who believe that we have a right to preserve our heritage, our culture, our rights, our land, our values. And the truth is, and of course this is what my book points out, Jewish supremacism, the real supremacists on this planet are the Jewish supremacists, because they not only want their own state of Israel, and they, by the way, they want to be totally supreme in that state and in the territories of which they conquer, where millions of other people live under their thumb, they want to be supreme over our lands. They want to control our media. They want to dictate to our government what it does, just as they literally dictated our moves with this terribly destructive Iraq war, which has done nothing but harm the basic interests of our country.
Well, besides their unity, one of the strengths of the Jewish supremacists, as Robert Kavjian has pointed out in a National Vanguard article, is that they constantly, in their media, play on the emotions of the people. They didn't buy up the TV networks and just start pushing their multiracialist agenda. They entertain people with stories and comedies. They're pushing the emotional buttons. How can we overcome that advantage?
We have got to resurrect the spirit of our people. You know, our liberation, the European-American liberation, is in our genes. The same genes that are in every cell of our body were in the cells of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. They were in the cells of Davy Crockett at the Alamo. They were in the cells of Leonidas at Thermopylae, and Charles Martel at Tours when he turned back the Moorish invasion. We have inside of us the seeds of liberation and freedom, and we have the seeds to go to the stars. And we have got to present to our people a way to bring out that passion, that beauty, because what we represent now, and what, you know, what we believe in is truly the way to the stars. Not only to the way to freedom in terms of a decent land with freedom and a decent schools for our kids and clean, healthy environment and all the rest of the things that are so important, but we're talking about some of the most basic and most important aspects of what life's all about. And we have to bring out that passion in our people. And I say this is the analogy I always use. Islam came along in about the 7th century A.D., and it fit the Arab nature. The Arabs were a number of warring tribes and had tremendous conflicts and different religions, but Islam fit their racial makeup. And it literally spread across the entire world from the shores of Spain all the way down into almost practically India in one single generation, a single generation. And that's the time of very slow communication and slow transport and travel and no videotapes and no telephones and no satellites and the rest of it. I really believe if our people, if we come up with the right formula and we are able to touch the spirits of our people, the deeper meanings of what this struggle is all about, I believe that we can put together and we show people the crisis that our people are in around the world, this crisis of existence. Unless we get together and organize, I believe that we can create something that will sweep our people faster than Islam swept the Arabs.
You're talking more than just emotions now. You're talking about something spiritual, David.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like I say, I believe it's in our genes, and I believe that in the spiral of our DNA, I think we have a stairway to the universe. It's a stairway to the stars. And we've got to look at the immediate threat to our people, the terrible losses that we're taking right now in terms of victims of crime, and the terrible losses we're taking in terms of our genes and our culture and our freedoms and our way of life. Look at the Patriot Act taking away the basic freedoms of the American people we've enjoyed for 200 years. But we are also talking about something to aim at and to fight for, because what we represent really is something that's beautiful. And it's really based, and I hate to sound like some sort of a liberal here, but it's really based on the highest ideals of love and beauty. Dostoevsky, who's one of my favorite novelists and one of the greatest writers, certainly Western civilization, he said, only beauty can save us. And what he meant was not just a surface physical beauty of some point, but a beautiful vision, a beautiful idea, and beautiful people. And the ideal of that in our hearts, that's what gives people passion. That's what brings out the courage in men. And it's courage, my friend, and it's courage, the people out there listening. That's the only thing that can save us at this point is passion. The hour is late. Our people are being driven to just destruction. Every European nation has massive immigration. Everyone has low birth rates. Everyone faces miscegenation. You know, our enemies control our mass communication network. They're involving us in this terrible so-called clash of civilization, which might end it all for us. You know, we are in a position of crisis, The only way we can win is by bringing out the passion that's in our people. But it's in our genes. We have to touch the spirit in our people. And certainly we have the greatest cause on earth. We have a cause that represents everything noble and great and beautiful in mankind. And we represent a people that are exquisitely beautiful, both in form and spirit and culture. Look at the great art of Western civilization. Look at the work of Michelangelo or Da Vinci. Look at our the writing of Shakespeare, the music of Mozart to Wagner. You know, the magnificence in our people. And all these beauties, all this greatness will be cast aside, will be lost forever unless we win. We have lots of reason to be passionate. We can look into the eyes of our children and feel this passion and this love. And that's all we need. I mean, there are literally millions, and I've seen this. You know, when I ran for office in Louisiana, and finally someone came along who defended the European American and suddenly became contagious. And every other house across the state, there, you know, there were 100,000 Duke signs that sprung up like mushrooms after the rain. You know, and this is what can happen in our lifetimes. In fact, this is what could happen this year or next year or within this decade. And that's why this conference is so important. I hope every patriot listening to this conference who can make it to New Orleans and come down and meet me and meet you and meet Eric Glebe and meet other leaders, Dr. Fields and many other leaders. Mr. Tyndall, of course, founder of the British National Party, is going to be there. And let's forge a way to make a victory for our kind over the next decade. It's feasible to win this cause in a decade. We just have to put together a formula that brings out that passion in our people, that love, that tradition, and that spiritual strength, which is inside of every one of us, if we just touch it.
David, I'm sorry to say, but we're running out of time, so let me thank you now for being a guest on American Dissident Voices, and I thank you also for all that you've done for the love of your people.
Thank you, Kevin, and I admire your work, and I look forward to seeing you down here in New Orleans very soon.
We'll see you there.
You have been listening to a presentation of American Dissident Voices. The program was sponsored as a public service by National Vanguard Books, America's foremost supplier of patriotic books and tapes. You may purchase a high-fidelity audio recording of this program or any earlier program for $12.95 postpaid. In ordering program tapes, be sure to mention the date and the subject of the program and the call letters of this radio station. For $2, we'll send you our newest 72-page illustrated catalog with descriptions and ordering information for more than 600 books and tapes of interest to patriots. Many of the items in the National Vanguard Books catalog are available nowhere else. Our mailing address is National Vanguard Books, Post Office Box 90, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA. Please write that address down now, because you may not hear this program again on this station. The forces of political correctness do not believe in free speech, and they do not like this program. Our address again is National Vanguard Books, Post Office Box 90, that's 90, Hillsboro, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA. Visit us on the internet at www.natvan.com. That's spelled NATVAN.com. Or www.natall.com. That's spelled NATALL.com. These American Dissident Voices programs are sponsored by donations from listeners like yourself. Please send a donation today to help us keep these programs on the air. This program is pre-recorded and comes to you from the United States of America.